Hi, everybody. My name's Helen. I'm an alcoholic. I'll make this brief and try to not be teary-eyed. I'm going to introduce the speaker this evening. I met him about 23 years ago. Surprisingly enough, I personally was struggling with, I had not drank for a long time, hanging around AA people, dating a guy in AA, and he sat me down and started reading me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me go back two steps. Because the first time I ever saw him, I didn't meet him. I was in a foster home, and I was on the phone with my dad. I was still using at the time. Pat was sober. And he came to pick up my foster sister to take her to an AA meeting. And I remember having a thought, I'm going to marry that man someday. And so then, let's go back to the AA part. Then he read me the big book no intentions except for to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. Long story short, we ended up getting married. We celebrated 20 years of marriage last week. Not that we haven't had our struggles, but due to Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of our understanding, I believe, we've been able to make it through all of these times. He's an excellent father. We've raised two kids. We have an exchange student living with us. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, sincerely, still to this day, when he comes home from work, I get butterflies. I'm madly in love with him. And as I've introduced him before, the part that I'm more right here is I'm more madly in love with what he has to offer to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've said many times, obviously I love him dearly and blah, 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 all that froofy stuff. And it would be heartbreaking if we ever split up. But the hardest part to me would be that I would not be able to be maybe part of what he gives to so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's probably one of the top five most giving people when it comes to the men that he sponsors and what he does for Alcoholics Anonymous. He is a walking big book, and I admire that. So with that, Pat. All
right. Hi, everyone. My name is Pat. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I guess that's a good definition of trust, letting your wife introduce you to me of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whew, okay. I'm a little not as nervous now. Okay. First, I want to start out by thanking Adam for asking me to speak here tonight. It's always an honor, it's always a privilege to speak at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I introduced myself as a recovered alcoholic because the book states, to me anyway, that I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And that is the primary purpose of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just, how did we do that? Yeah, I'm going to need more than one. I am a member of the Northside Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're a Steps in Tradition meeting. We meet on Sunday night in Eau Claire, Wisconsin at 7 o'clock. If you want to hear about the steps and traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, please join us. It's a great meeting. We start at 7 p.m. We end at 8 p.m. If you're interested in going to a meeting and hearing about a person's day or problems, don't come to our meeting. I'm just being honest with you. That's not what our meeting's about. Our meeting's about the steps and traditions. And that's all right, you know, because when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know that meetings were structured differently, that within the traditions each group can do that. And if I don't like a particular meeting, that's okay. And I don't think there's a bad meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just know for myself, in my own recovery, that I need to attend a certain type of meeting. And for me, it's a meeting that talks about steps. That's me. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate that. Dan's one of my favorite people. I don't get to see him that often. The book also tells me that I need to share, in a general way, what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. And I, you know, I always struggle, and I do this every time that I've been asked to speak at a meeting, is how do you begin? How do you start with all that? Because it's, It's interesting and fascinating, and I remember one time I spoke at the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they recorded it, and a little while later I gave this tape to a friend of mine, and she listened to the tape, and she gave it back to me, and she said, "Man, it was like a roller coaster ride." And I was like, "Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, I lived through it all. It was a roller coaster ride." What I'll share tonight is exactly that, in my best ability, to be honest. I got to share this, though, that understand, again, my interpretation of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous is my experience, and no right or wrong. It's just my experiences. So, and I was thinking this right before I got up. I was looking over Mary Jo. I don't even know how many times you've heard me speak, and it's like, why are you still here? Because it's like, I was just at the Pacific Group, too, not that long ago. But that's always fun. If you ever get a chance to go to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Eau Claire, you need to go. If you need some energy, you need a plug, you need some enthusiasm, please attend that meeting. It's a wonderful meeting for enthusiasm. So let's see. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mom's an alcoholic. I can remember as a little child that my relatives tell me, I can remember my aunt actually telling me distinctly that my mom was a practicing alcoholic. And I can remember thinking distinctly that I never thought she needed to practice. She seemed to do just fine. What does that mean to me today? It doesn't really mean a lot to me today. It's just my ethnic background is kind of how I consider it. Because for a long period of time, I used to blame a lot of my problems on my parents and anybody else that kind of crossed my path. But I used to blame my parents for a lot of things. And today I understand that I'm the adult and I'm responsible for my own solutions. And so I don't do that anymore. I think my parents did the absolute best that they could do. The interesting part was this. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember that because there were like 12 things that they like read before the meeting, and then there were like 12 things they read at the end of the meeting. I didn't know what they were, you know, and I wasn't all interested in what they were saying, but I had to be there, which is really interesting. It was like mid-1970s, the first time I ever went to a meeting. And again, I was like 7 or 8 years old. Interesting enough, that was about the same time I started drinking. I've heard in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous about people that, you know, they waited until they were like in high school, or they waited until they were starting college before they drank. And my immediate thought when I hear that is, how in God's name did you last that long? How did you make it? I mean, as far back as my memory takes me, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I really was. And 7 years old, going into the fridge, grabbing 2 bottles of Lionkugels and going out in the sandbox to play, that was a good afternoon for me. It was. It was fine. You know, I had no problems with it. 2 bottles would put me on my caboose. I mean, I'd be, you know, but I got what I was looking for. You know what I mean? I just wanted that. That's what I wanted. And alcohol provided that for me. All the chaos and all the insanity that was going on around me, it got me out of that for a period of time. As you can imagine. Now, truthfully, I mean, this is how things went in my life. My mom would not drink for periods of time, and then she'd drink again, and then she, you know, the beer would be gone, and then she'd drink for a while, and then she'd go back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and somewhere along the line, she got a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I lived in this little town called Thorpe. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. A little town called Thorpe, and her sponsor lived in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. So on Friday nights, we would drive down. She'd drag me along. We would drive down to Chippewa Falls so she could go to a meeting with her sponsor, and I would then hook up with her son, her sponsor's son, David, who was a friend of mine, and they would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Chippewa Falls, and me and David would go over to Bill's house and drink and hope that our parents would get better. Serious, that's what it was like. That's just what it was like. David and I started drinking, and it was a weekend thing. We would drink as much as we could during the weekends when we were together. Interesting enough, David died 6 years ago from cirrhosis of the liver. He was 35. That's what alcoholism does. But we were just kids, you know. We were just doing what we were doing. And all I knew is that I never liked the taste of beer. I'm just being truthful here. I just had to slam the first one. Once the first one was down, then it was fine. You know what I mean? It was, then it didn't matter anymore. Brandy, different story. Absolutely loved Brandy. Just couldn't have enough of that. What else happened when I was drinking? There was a lot. I mean, I was struggling because I'm not going to share a great deal about my drunken log. I'll share enough that you can understand that I qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous. So I do qualify. I can guarantee you that I qualified long before I actually got here. But, you know, as the book also, and drugs were part of my story, you know. I know sometimes I've spoken at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and there's like some hardcore, just chronic alcoholics, and they don't want to hear about the drugs. Well, you know what? If you actually read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the description of the alcoholic. And it actually talks about how, as some of us progress, we get prescribed sedatives or morphine. That happened for me. You know, if he handed me a pill, I didn't ask what it was. I just took it, you know. And if it was a birth control pill, of course, it didn't do anything. But if you handed me a joint, I didn't care. I just smoked it. If it was there, I took it, you know. What I know today that I didn't know then, but what I know today because I've worked through the steps and I've taken a personal inventory is alcohol was reliable. That's why it was what I used. That's what it was always there because it was reliable. I knew what it would do for me. And with drugs, I mean, there's no quality control out there. You had no idea what it would do to you until you had it in you, you know. So, again, that was just my experience. I would use what was ever there. I lived out in the country. And, you know, in Wisconsin, we have this wonderful country bars. I don't know if any of you have ever noticed those. And I was about 6 miles out in the country, and a half a mile down the road was a bar called Aquarium Bar. And that was a cool thing for me, you know, when I was about 13, 14. What was really cool is if you drank enough and smoked some dope and sat at the bar, you could just space out and watch the fish swim around, unless you threw up. And then they'd all run away, and they wouldn't come back. But I loved Aquarium Bar. It was a great bar. And one night, I remember this distinctly, I had a friend of mine, I think I was actually 15 at this time. Her name was Lynn. She shared the locker right next to me in high school. I had this plan to go out. I would do things like I'd be running out of the house on Friday afternoon, and my dad would look at me and say, be home by midnight. And Sunday night, right before midnight, I come running in the house, and she didn't tell me which night, you know. that was what I usually do. But I was running out. I remember setting up this plan with Lynn because I think I'd gotten into trouble or something. I wasn't supposed to be out late. Truthfully, I don't remember. I just remember setting up this plan where Lynn would pick me up at like 11 o'clock down by Aquarium Bar, and we had, you know, go to a bar, party, go to a bar. and I remember sitting in the ditch. You know, I snuck out of the house. That wasn't that hard to do anymore. And I was sitting in the ditch. The car came up, and there's Lynn in the car picking me up. And Lynn was, and I'm 15 years old, and Lynn was an attractive young lady. And sitting in the car also was her sister Sue, who was also a young, attractive lady. And it was one of those cars where, you know, if I could have sat in the middle, in the front, you know, between the two of them. It made perfect sense to me at 15 years old, right? Well, as I get up to the car, and Sue's getting out so I can get in the car, I notice in the back there's two cases of beer. And, I mean, it's instinctual. In the blink of an eye, I sat in back. Of course I'm going to sit in back, you know? But it just tells me where my priorities were. It was that way. It was just like that. It was just like that. Actually, Lynn and Sue ended up, I just thought of that. They sang at our wedding. I just remembered that. small world. As I continued to drink, a lot of things would continue to happen to me. I seemed to always get into trouble when I was already in trouble. Meaning I would, you know, if I was already in detention, I would still get in trouble when I'm in detention. I mean, if we smoked some, and seriously, I mean, usually there would be a bottle of vodka in my locker in my high school. I mean, it was always right up there in the back and right. And if Bill grabbed me or somebody else and we'd smoke some dope. I remember one time, I just remember being really hungry, okay? Now, I'd gotten up in the morning, had some vodka, smoked a little something on the side, and there were like, I don't know, they didn't refill the machines, but there were no potato chips. There was absolutely nothing in these machines. And so me and Chuck decided, of course, that if we can't eat here, we're going to have to leave the school to get something to eat because we can't survive the next class without something to eat. So we left, of course, went to the grocery store, and I ended up getting, I don't know why, usually it was potato chips, but they had these really big donuts. they called him Bigfoot. I mean, it looked like a Bigfoot. And it was really good donuts. And so we bought some donuts, and we're trying to sneak into the back of the high school, and the principal's standing there, Mr. Conroe. And he looks at us, and he had some choice words for me and Chuck, and that part I could live with. I mean, I knew I was wrong, but he took the donuts. And that really pissed me off. And this is the way it works for me. Okay, this is the way it works for me. I wreak havoc with people, places, and things, and not necessarily in that order. And nor do I need to be under the influence of alcohol or be drunk to do that. Okay? And it doesn't take a lot for me to grab a resentment. Now, all this seems kind of funny, maybe all that, maybe not that significant. But the truth was, a week later, Mr. Conroe couldn't get out of his chair. Seriously, he couldn't get up out of his chair, and he had to call EMTs to cut him out of his chair because I had superglued him to his chair. Now again, all this seems kind of fun, and it's not. I mean, I don't want to hurt other people, but that's the way I did things. If I had a resentment against you, I was going to get you, and you just didn't know when. Okay, you just didn't know when. And I would hold those things, and I would stay angry. I can remember at 16 thinking, how can I get rid of my parents? Because they're problematic. And they're problematic because they keep getting in my way. I just want to drink. That's all I want to do. And they just keep getting in my way. So one night comes along, and it was an unusual thing also for, you know, my parents called the police and, you know, everybody's looking for me and, you know, that midnight thing. And I remember one night I'm sitting at this restaurant because I was a blackout drinker. You know, I drink and I would blackout and I would come to, okay? And what I mean by that, if those of us experience that, I mean, I would come to and I'd be doing a lot of different things. I could be driving a car. I could be sitting at somebody's house that I did not know. I came to once in Indianapolis. I have no idea to this day why I was in Indianapolis, but I was in Indianapolis. So I would just come to and I remember coming to this restaurant in Thorpe, and it was, I don't know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and Chad and Bill were sitting across the table from me, and everybody's laughing, and I could not tell you what had been going on for the last few days. It wasn't there. And Chad had this malt in his face, and I thought it was funny, so I started laughing. And then and then everybody stopped laughing, and I couldn't figure out why everybody stopped laughing. And then somebody tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around. My mom and dad were standing there. They'd been looking for me for a few days, and there was a police officer with them too, and maybe that's why everybody stopped laughing. It occurred to me then. anyway, I can remember, again, bits and pieces of that night. I remember them taking me home. I got a nice discussion with the police officer again. And I remember putting the barrel of a shotgun in my mouth. I remember that distinctly. And that was it. I came to in the morning. Didn't feel the best, but I came to. And I knew something was wrong because the gun was gone. My shotgun on my room. I went downstairs. There was a big bullet hole in the kitchen wall where I put a round through, and I didn't know it was me, but I guess I did. My parents were sitting in the living room, and they told me to come down and sit there, and I did. And here's another part I have to just bring out, because people in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous want to talk about shame, okay? And I know what shame is. That night, my mom ran uptown in her vehicle to get a police officer because she needed help. And she didn't do that because she was ashamed. She did that because she was desperate. She was desperate. Because her 16-year-old son had just tried killing her. She was desperate. That's what happens with alcoholism, my experience. My parents told me that I was going to go down to Chippewa Falls and talk to a counselor. And my honest to God thought was, that's not a bad idea. You guys need help. Not a bad idea. You guys might be able to find something you can use. Maybe be better parents, you know, something like that. So on Monday, and I'll never forget this because I was trying to make something to eat. Not that I did well or did often, but I was making some hamburgers, and my dad just came up to the stove and shut the stove off and said, "You're coming with us." Okay. Grabbed the hamburgers, and I went in the car. And they drove me down to Ellie Phillips Treatment Center in Chippewa Falls. Make a long story really short, is I did end up talking to this counselor. They just left out the part about how long it would be I'd be talking to this counselor because they left, and I stayed there. They never told me that part. Just left that right out. Oh, that irritated me. And I found out again years later, and this I share because it gives you an idea of how severe things had gotten. They had wanted to put me in a place called Fairview Deaconess, which is a locked inpatient facility in Minneapolis for adolescents. And the only reason they put me at Ellie Phillips, which was an open campus, is because 2 months prior to this, I tried killing myself. It's a long story. I dove off a cliff, landed on a rock. And it would take me half an hour to walk from here to those doors. I mean, seriously, I just could hardly walk. So they felt comfortable putting me somewhere where it was still an open campus. So I spent, I don't know, 30-some days there. And at this point, I knew there was a problem in my life. Okay, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And chances are, I was probably an alcoholic. I just didn't care. Truthfully, I just didn't care that much. They told me to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just on a side note, I will try to keep this to an hour because my caboose can endure what my mind can absorb what my caboose can endure. That's what I wanted to say without swearing. Anyway, they told me to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the very first meeting I ever went to was a Tuesday night in Stanley, Wisconsin, 8 o'clock. And I walked in there and everybody was like ancient, you know. I mean, they were like in their 40s, you know. I mean, the closest person my age was my mom. But they seemed really nice. I mean, they shook my hand and they seemed very nice. Not well, but they seemed nice. And I just wished them well, you know. I wasn't that impressed with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just being honest here. It's just my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I went to. I didn't go there because I had a desire to stop drinking. I didn't go there because I wanted to change my life or any of those things. I went there to get the heat off. That's just the honest God truth. I just wanted people to get off my back. I just wanted my parents to get away, some police officers, specific ones, my brother and some other relatives and the principal that was still after me for some reason. And I just wanted people to get off my back. So I would still go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, not because I wanted to be sober. Actually, what went through my mind is, okay, if I'm an alcoholic, then I should just smoke some weed. That's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to smoke pot. And I did. I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 days out of treatment. And I probably made it a week or two, maybe 2 weeks. I don't honestly remember before I started drinking again. And so I would then go. This is what I would do. I would then go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and be blown out of my mind at times because as some of us experience, I'm sure, we stand outside at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and people will talk about things they've done and laugh. Have you ever noticed that? And some of the things they're talking about, I didn't think were that funny. Really? And so I couldn't believe you guys were sober. You had to be going to the bars afterwards, so I would go to the bar afterwards, making sure you guys weren't there. That's what I would do. There would be times I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a bottle of brandy in my inside jacket pocket. Because why wait? Really. You know, why wait? honestly, years later, this was probably 8 years ago, I was at my home group, which was actually Sunday night in Chippewa Falls at that time. And my old sponsor was there, Rick, and he was telling my story to one of the guys I sponsored at the time about how I would go to meetings with brandy in my inside jacket pocket, and I thought nobody would knew, you know. Rick knew all along. Anyway, if you haven't caught on to this, I was sort of a binge drinker, and when I started, I couldn't stop. See, I take a drink, the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes me. That's the simplicity of my drinking. Once I start, I cannot predict what will occur, what will happen. I simply am gone. That's what happens. And I got on a binge that I wanted to stop, and I couldn't stop, but I wanted to. And I remember coming to, standing outside Ellie Phillips Treatment Center. And the girl, I was with a girl, and it's a long story, I ain't going there, but she was walking into the treatment center, and I'm standing there, door open, by the car, and I'm like, where are you going? And I remember her turning around looking at me, saying, well, I need some help, I'm going to go into treatment. And I was like, well, good for you. There's a whole bottle of peppermint schnapps in the back of the car. What's the hurry, you know? So I drank the rest of the peppermint schnapps, and I went into the treatment center. And here's what I had. Here's what I had. I had a duffel bag with a couple pairs of jeans, a T-shirt, a tape player, Beerless Squire tape because I was cool, and a car I'd stolen. That's how I got there, and a car that I'd stolen. And I walked into the treatment center, and there were two nurses on duty. I'm going to share this again because it's just my story. And I always had a problem with nurses back then. I don't know why. But I told the first one she looked like a reject out of a horror movie, and she kind of did. Truthfully, she did. Anyway, the other one had these really big teeth, and I was a little scared of her, so I didn't say anything to her. And back then, I don't know if it's still true to this day, but back then when you were in detox, they gave you these pajamas to wear. They call them detox pajamas, and I call them monkey suits, you know. But I don't know to this day if the nurse, she gave me these pajamas to wear and told me to go in the bathroom and change. And so I went there, and I don't know to this day if she was just irritated with me or if she honestly made a mistake, because I put the bottoms on. Wasn't that hard, not a big deal. And I went to put what I thought were the tops. She'd given me two bottoms. There was a hole there. I couldn't get my head through it. I tried. I really tried. And I remember falling into the bathtub, banging my head. Nurse comes running in to ask me if I'm having a problem. No, I'm fine. Thank you. You know? Good. Good. They wouldn't give me any more pajamas. They just gave me this robe to wear after that for the rest of the night. So I'm sitting in detox, and a thought came. And people have asked me many times, what happened? What happened? And the thought was this: I don't want to live like this anymore. That's what it was. That's all it was. I don't want to live like this anymore. And I don't care what it takes to stay sober. I don't care anymore what I got to do. If there's a divine intervention anywhere, I think it started there for me. I didn't know it, didn't realize it, didn't comprehend it. I just didn't want to live like this anymore. So I went through treatment there, and I would love to tell you that that I stopped drinking and everything changed for me. That was not my experience. In fact, the book actually says very clearly that stopping drinking is just the beginning. It is just the beginning. The actual applications of the principles and values of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is then the challenge to practice these principles in all our affairs. That's the difficult part. So, yeah, again, I'd love to tell you I changed dramatically. Didn't happen. Found out that you can't break into the kitchen at night and steal shrimp. They really get really irritated about that. And they would take all my clothes and they would put me back in those detox pajamas whenever I got in trouble. Honest to God, I wore those pajamas more than I wore my regular clothes when I was in treatment. It's just, you know, I couldn't stop myself. Well, and I loved shrimp, okay? I still do. Anyway. So I leave treatment, and they tell me I need to go back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They tell me I need to find a sponsor. Yeah, maybe they told me that the first time I didn't hear. But so I started going back to this meeting, and I started listening to a guy that I used to really, even though I wasn't serious about being sober, I used to like listening to him at the meetings. He had a lot of profound things to say. I didn't understand them, but they sounded really cool. So one night I was probably not a month out of treatment yet, maybe 3 weeks, maybe 2 weeks. I just remember it wasn't very long, and I went up to Rick after a meeting on a Friday night in Connaught, Wisconsin, and I looked at him and I said, Rick, would you be my sponsor? And I can be honest with you guys, that was the most frightening thing I think I'd ever done in my life to that point. And I knew fear, but that terrified me. Because if he said no, where would I be? Where would I be? So Rick looked at me, right square in the eye, and he said, are you willing to go any lengths to stay sober? And I was like, dude, in my mind, I'm like, dude, I just got out of treatment. You got to mellow out a little bit. And I was like, yeah, I think so. And he looked at me and he said, no, are you, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I am. And he got all a list of things. He got a pen out and a paper, and he got all a list of things I had to do each day to stay sober. He said, you got to read chapter 5, how it works every morning you wake up. I was like, the whole chapter? He's like, no, rarely have we seen a person fail through A, B, and C. He said, I have no understanding of your God or of your higher power, but you need to ask your God for help in the morning. You need to thank your higher power at night. Okay. He said, we're going to go through the steps together. I'm like, well, you know, Rick, I've been to treatment twice, done it a couple times already, you know. He's like, no, we're going to go through the steps together. Okay. And then he did it. And then he set the hook. And the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous know how to do this, and they know how to do it well, because he looked me in the eye and he said, I'm going to guarantee you two things. The first thing is, you're never going to have to take another drink again as long as you live. In my mind, I'm thinking you're insane. And he says, you don't believe me. I said, no, I don't. He said, that's okay. He said, but I'm going to guarantee you one more thing. You're never going to have to feel lonely again. You're never going to have to feel lonely again. And I knew what he meant. I knew what he meant. It wasn't just a word to me. I've been lonely my whole life. I've been terrified my whole life. And so I did the only thing I could do. I started to follow Rick around like a little puppy dog. And I did whatever he suggested, no matter what it was. And I'd love to tell you that I always thought he had good ideas. I didn't. I thought some of his ideas were pretty dumb. But I did them anyway. Because I didn't know. He said, you have to go start making coffee. You have to be here half an hour before the meeting. Maybe 45 minutes would be better. Well, first of all, no one would trust me to drive their car. For some reason. So I had to get rides to meetings. No one would let me drive their car. But I talked to my parents and let me come to the meeting 45 minutes early so I could make coffee. And I don't drink coffee. I don't drink coffee to this day. But I had to make coffee. And then after about 3 months, he said, now you can start cleaning up after the meeting. You get the broom and clean up and put the chairs away. Okay. Now, I didn't know then what I know now is what Rick was doing was keeping me busy. He was keeping me busy enough till I could start working the steps. He knew that. I didn't know that. And he kept me doing all these things, going to meetings, taking me to Appleton. I'll never forget the first area meeting I was at. I was just telling Mary Jo about it. It was absolutely insane. And people like standing on tables, screaming at each other. I'm not kidding. It was crazy back then. And I didn't know what I was doing there. You know, why am I here? Rick's just like, you come with me. And I started on a journey beyond my wildest drunken dreams. It truly is. We went through these steps, and that's where I need to begin. The first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And what Rick explained to me was the first part of the step had nothing to do with the second part of the step, because there's a hyphen there, it means just separation of thought. I didn't know that. I thought my life was unmanageable because I drank. No, he's able to clearly point out, first of all, I had all the requirements I needed to get the first step. I didn't need any more practice. That I was powerless of alcohol. I didn't have a difficult time concept with that. Certainly my life was unmanageable. I can mess up my life today, and I don't need to take a drink to do that. I really don't. He explained that to me. He made it clear to me. There's a description of alcoholic. I fit it to a T. I had no problems with any of that. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That was a bit of a struggle. I'm just being truthful here. I had no religious background. I have none. We went to the bar on Sunday mornings. That's what we did. So I have no church. I have no religious education, no background in it. And he said, I got to pick a God. I got to have a higher power. And I'm like, I don't have any, Rick. You don't understand. That was one of my favorite words. You don't understand. And Rick would always come back with, we seek to understand rather than to be understood. Now, I didn't know that was part of 11-step prayer, but he was good at that. So I says, I'm going to pick AA. That'll be my higher power. And he's like, that's fine. That's fine. There's no problems with that. You just need a higher power. Okay. After about 3 months, I guess September, October, 4 months, actually, I remember going up to Rick on a Friday night after the meeting, and I said, you know, Rick, I need like a spiritual awakening. I need something big. You know, parting of the waters, burning bush, something, you know. I just need something. And Rick just smiled and said, yeah, just keep saying your prayers. Exactly 1 week later, I'm driving home. It was Friday night, middle of December. It was the very first time somebody let me drive with a car since I've been in treatment second time. And I'm going north, 2 miles east of Stanley, up on Highway 29. And I came up with this little hill. And I'm not speeding. I'm not in a hurry. I'm not drunk. You know, I'm just trying to get home so I can get home, get changed, get to the meeting in Connaught on Friday night. And I come up with this little hill, and I went to hit the brake, and as soon as I hit the brake, I realized, yeah, this sucks, because I'm not going to stop. It's glare ice. You know, and you realize, of course, it's a blinking eye, right? But in that same instance that I realized that it was glare ice, in the corner of my eye, I caught an 18-wheeler coming down the highway. And so my immediate thought was, I'm going to take the ditch. You know, that's about all I can do here. So I took my foot off the brake, and I punched the accelerator, and the car did a complete 180, and the semi hit me in the passenger side and sent me 200 feet down the highway. And I got to say this because it still bothers me to this day. I actually just heard this 2 weeks ago. Somebody told me about a little fender bender they got in, and they were like, it felt like I got hit by a Mack truck. I'm here to tell you, unless you get hit by a Mack truck, you have no flipping idea what it feels like. It was unbelievable. And I remember the car coming to a stop, and I wanted the engine was still running, so I thought I should shut the engine off because maybe it'll blow up. I didn't know, but I couldn't shut it off because, like, the steering wheel was over here. And I thought, well, maybe I should get out of the car, but I couldn't because the door was jammed and the other door was, like, here. So I just flew out. Well, there's no window. I just went out the window, right? And I remember walking over the ditch and laying down in the snow and screaming, why? Why me? And this is the first time somebody trusted me to drive their car. It's done. Car's gone. Car's gone. Officer Serafin, Frank, as I knew him, stopped by a few minutes later, and I'm still sitting in the snow, right? And Frank comes walking up to me. I'll never forget this. And he says, he looked at me and he said, blow into this. And I got out my 3-month medallion. And I said, Frank, I'm sober. No, blow into this. Frank! I had to blow into it, which was fine. I went into his car. I started to defrost a little bit. There was some glass in my eye. And actually, Frank had a little concern. He drove me to the hospital. I walked away. No broken bones. Nothing. And I remember calling Rick later that night to explain to him why I had missed the meeting at my home group. And he said that was the only good excuse he'd ever heard for missing the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, screw you. And about 3 weeks later, I was talking to him about step three. And he asked me a very simple question. What were you screaming at? What were you yelling at? Maybe you came to believe. Careful what you wish for. So we went into step three. And Rick would do things like, you need to memorize the third step prayer. Well, okay. Now, this is again my experience. When I walked back into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, in detox, I weighed 115 pounds. I was the same height then as I am now. I'd been on a long run, okay? Things weren't firing real well upstairs for me yet. I mean, I could read a page and then turn the page and have no idea what even chapter I'm in yet. You know, I mean, it just wouldn't stay, wouldn't retain. Things, I mean, I can remember thinking things and it'd be like, did I see that on the TV or hear it on the radio? Or am I just making that up? You know, I mean, it just wouldn't click for me very well. But he said, you need to memorize the third step prayer. So I wrote it down and stuck it everywhere, like in my room and the mirrors. And somehow I got it done. Somehow I knew it. Relieve me of the bondage of self is what the prayer says. So I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties. A victory over them may I bear witness to those that would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. What happened for me, and I didn't know it was going to be this way, was it's a very difficult prayer to recite. And as much as I love the Serenity Prayer, in my mind I can say it way too fast. And it's coming and going. It's gone. But the third step prayer actually slows me down. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Oh, I was the problem all along. I was starting to get a little bit. A little bit. Well, once you get into the fourth step, it's really hard to keep blaming. At least that was my experience. If you do it as the book describes, you know, resentments. Okay, I had a few. Fears, had a lot. Sexual inventory, personal relations. Oh, man. Rick again explained it to me very simply. It's an inventory. It's like a business. You know, if business doesn't take inventory, they don't stay in business. You don't do a four-step, you don't get to stay sober. It's that simple. You don't have to do a four-step. Just go drink if you don't want to. That simple. He'd do that to me all the time. Whenever I'd get that look like I was going to argue with him. It's like, you can drink. Go ahead. It's okay. The book actually says, if you're not sure, drink. And he'd tell me that. If you're not sure, go drink. Okay. Suddenly, in the midst of a fifth step, I'm telling another human being everything there is to know about me. Everything there is to know about me. In the midst of a fifth. And if you look into the book, it actually starts asking you some questions. Don't you love that after you do the fifth step? It asks you some questions. And it asks questions like, have you made mortar without sand? It's asking you about the foundation of recovery that you now have. Because if you have a foundation, you may walk through this ark, a free man at last. A free man. That's all I ever wanted to be, was free. Step six. Humbly asked him, step six. When Taylor ready, what is step six? When Taylor ready to have a respective character. So, yes, that was right. Thank you. Brain fart. Anyway, Rick explains steps 6 and 7 as the lost steps. And I'll tell you what he said. And actually, Adam and I were talking about this before the meeting. Adam said that he says my sayings. I didn't know I had sayings. Anyway, what Rick explained to me was this. Well, no, I got to be more honest. There are slogans in Alcoholics Anonymous that still bother me to this day. I'm just being honest here, guys. There just are. Keep coming back. What's the spiritual significance of that? What's that mean? Keep coming back. This too shall pass. Don't you love that one? I just want to slap somebody when they tell me that, you know? Or easy does it. Easy does it. I like that one a little bit. But the slogans always bothered me, but Rick always would tell me one that made the most sense. He said, the same man will drink. The same man will drink. Meaning, if I don't apply these principles and make some changes in my life, in my affairs, I will drink again. I will drink again. Humbly. Now, I have a little struggle with humbly. That's minimizing it. Rick said that I was arrogant. I had to look that up. And that one of the things he suggested that very first day I asked him to be my sponsor is he said, you need to pray for humility. You cannot pray for anything else for you, just humility. Now, again, I had no idea what humility was, but it sounded really profound and cool, so okay, I'll do that. I'll pray for humility. All right. I was sober probably a year, and I decided to reward myself because Rick also told me that I had to be self-supporting through my own contributions, meaning I had to like get a job, and I couldn't steal anymore. So I got a job, and after about a year of sobriety, I decided to reward myself, and I bought a 1976 King Cobra Mustang II. And my wife may argue with you, but I still think that's why she's with me to this day. But anyway, hey, she started dating me, you know. So I got this really cool car, and I can remember the first time I took it to Knott on a Friday night to show Rick. And I said, Rick, you got to see my car. And he came out there, and he said, you know, it looks like it's an extension of your ego. And I was like, no, it's a car. I didn't get it. I just didn't get what he meant. So I had the car about a year, and I'm driving home one night. And it was one of those weird nights where it was foggy. And what I mean by that is you'd go into the fog, and then it'd be clear, and then you could see, like, the next fog bank, right? And I'd hit the next fog bank, and then it'd be clear, and hit the next fog bank, and then there's a cow standing in the middle of the road. And I hit the cow. I tried to miss the cow, but it was right in the middle of the road. It came right up over the top of my car. That's how hard I hit it. And I was really pissed. I mean, I can remember kicking it when I got out of the car. Like the cow was going to survive. It didn't. The reality is, I didn't need that car. Reality is, it was an extension of my ego. God gives me what I cannot give myself. It does. It happens all the time. I started to understand some things about humility through those experiences and through what Rick continued to teach me. I was talking about someone this week. The reason I think I can still stay sober today is not because I've been sober so many years. I don't get to stay sober based upon my years of sobriety or based upon what I did last year or last month. I get to stay sober based on what I do today. That's what keeps me sober. That's what keeps me in the game. And I have to stay teachable. I have to stay teachable. 8. Made a list of all persons. I won't forget that one. Anybody ever read that step clearly? I thought it was a typo. I mean, I went from the third edition to the second edition thinking all persons we had harmed. Can't be. It's got to be a typo. But it actually says that. All persons we had harmed. Okay. So I didn't understand how do you even begin that? And Rick, again, very simply, put things together for me. Amends that we make right away. Amends that we wait for. Amends that there's statutes of limitations for. You know, that's how you do that. Okay, I got it. All right. So, but I'd have messed it all up. I'd have put the ones that I thought should wait. And I mean, I would have messed them all up. But Rick helped me through that. He explained the step for me. And he used one of his favorite sayings for me. For like the first 6 months, I'd always sit right across the table from him at this meeting on Friday night. And when I got done talking, whatever the topic might be, he would look at me and he'd say, "Keep it simple, stupid," right in the meeting. I thought it was kind of rude. I was like, "You can't do that in a meeting." After like 6 months, I remember going up to him after a meeting one night, and I said, "Rick, you know, you tell me that so much, I'm starting to feel stupid." And he looked at me and he laughed. He said, "I think you're getting better." Yeah, okay. May direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Except when to do so would injure them or others. It's a terrifying experience for me. It was terrifying asking people to forgive me and then asking them, and this was the part that I really struggled with, but Rick told me it was imperative, what I could do to right it, what I could do to right this wrong. Most of my amends went very well. I'd love to tell you they all went great. Not my experience. There were not some people that were thrilled that I'd found sobriety or a spiritual path in which to live. Not everyone was. But the promises that were read tonight actually occur in the book after step 9. It's after step 9. And that's where things started to change some for me. More clearly could I see now. More clearly could I understand rather than to be understood. We got to step 10. And I have to share this because it's so imperative for me today. Rick would do things like, did you ever notice there's contradictions in the book Alcoholics Anonymous? Contradicts itself. Now, I'm good at picking those things out. I can spot a contradiction a mile away. Somebody says something and does something different, or the book's not, you know. The book says I have no mental defense against the first drink. None. Says that very clearly. Later in the book, it says, this program is 100% guaranteed. It never fails. Interesting, isn't it? The reason I bring that up is because Rick told me I had to find that. It says somewhere in the book that it's 100% guaranteed. It never fails. Find it. I was living in Kentucky when I found that. That was like 5 years later. Oh, that would irritate me because I just keep looking. You know, again, he kept me busy, kept me reading the book. I do that stuff all the time. Step 10, he'd do things like, what is the most important word of all the words in the 12 steps? I don't know, God. He's like, no. He'd laugh, walk away. Just irritate me. No, he'd laugh, walk away. Finally, we got to step 10. He looked at me, the most important word of all the words in the 12 steps, the first word of the 10th. Continue. If I don't continue to do this, I don't get to stay here. If I don't continue to talk to my sponsor, read the book, or go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't get to be here. That's my experience. Continue to take personal inventory, and I was wrong, promptly admitted it. And then if you read the book, again, it's got some areas that it says that I need to focus on. Imagine that. Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Those are pretty good areas for me. I can't talk for anybody else here tonight, but those are pretty good areas for me. Because again, it doesn't take long for me to cop a resentment. I don't know why. I mean, I can walk into my house and dishes aren't done. I'm pissed at Helen. Why didn't you do the dishes? You know, I'm already upset. Of course, one day she finally threw something at me and said, "Well, if you want the dishes done, do them." You know, that's all that problem for her. I'd love to tell you that I wake up in the morning and I think of you. That's not my experience. I wake up in the morning and I think of me. Selfishness. Selfishness. Dishonesty? Well, Helen loves to talk about this one because I got my license renewed about 2 years ago. And I shrunk 3 inches. I was no longer 5'8". I put my honest to God height on there. It's 5'5". Honesty. I'm not 5'8". I was really hoping, you know, I just never changed it. Like since I was 16. Sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. Yeah. Honesty. I don't know why that when someone asks me a question to this day, sometimes my first thought is a lie. I don't know why that is. Not that long ago, I was actually sitting in a courtroom. I work with a judge. And somebody had handed me something to read, and I was reading this, and somebody was having a conversation with this judge, and suddenly it occurred to me that I should probably be listening to the conversation, not reading this. So I looked up, and as I looked up, the judge looked at me and said, "You think this is a good idea?" I had no idea what she was talking about. I wasn't paying attention. And I wanted to say, "Yeah, that's a great idea. You should go do that." And instead, I was like, No, I better be honest with this one. I'm sorry, Judge. I didn't hear the words you said. And I felt like that big, you know. But honesty, it's still a struggle for me to this day. It still is. Fear. I really think I was born afraid. I really do. Because you guys still scare me. Not as bad. Not as much. But you still do. Rick once told me that fear was a lack of faith. And when he told me that, I wanted to hit him. Because I didn't understand what he meant by that. I got a little better idea today. And I'll share what I mean by that. Throughout my recovery, I've done many interesting things. One of the things I ended up doing in my recovery is I joined the Army. I'm not saying that's a good idea for anybody in here tonight. That's just what I did. And since I'm going to do it, I joined the infantry. I was a 19 Delta Cavalry Scout infantry. And, of course, my son decided to do this not that long ago, and he had to one-up me. He went airborne. Just had to make it a little better than Dad. And so he went airborne. And on April 3rd of this year, he went to Iraq. I know a little bit about fear. I know a little bit about terror. But because you guys have given me some principles in which I can live upon, it gives me the ability to have the spiritual faith and the spiritual muscle to walk around with my head held high. The book tells me I'm a child of God, and I don't crawl before anyone. And I don't. And what I can do today is say some simple prayers. I start out every day. If you've heard me talk before, this is what it is. I get up in the morning and I say, God be with me. It's going to be a real busy day. That's my prayer. That's what begins it all. Somewhere along the line throughout the day, if I can muster anything else for a prayer, it's a plus and it's a bonus. And believe me, in the last 4 or 5 months, there's been many throughout the day. So it keeps me centered. Because of what the steps have really taught me and what you guys have given me is simply this. I'm not in charge. I just like to think I am. I just think I'm a good director. I suck at directing, but I think I'm a good director, and that's the problem. Hence lies the problem, me. It's always been me. I'd love to tell you that all the places I ended up drinking, that alcohol got me there. There was the alcohol and drugs that got me in all those places. It wasn't. It was me. It was always me. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Took me a while to grasp that. When I joined the Army, I got stationed in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I was telling Adam this, that it took me a year to find a home group down there. And I looked, and it took me a year and a half to find a sponsor. And I just kept running up my long-distance phone calls back then, kept calling my sponsor here. And I found this guy that I don't know if I've ever met a more serene or calm human being in my life. Really. His name was Kenny E. And nothing ever seemed to bother this guy. And I would try to bother him. It didn't bother him. I mean, it was just like he was so calm. He would tell me things like the kingdom of God comes from within. That your problems are not outside of yourself. The problems are within. And I'd be like, no, Kenny, follow me around and I can show you my problems. He's like, no. Can't change the wind, you can only adjust the sail, was typically his response. Kenny explained to me that what goes on outside of me is what goes on. What I do with it on the inside is what matters. How I respond to these things. And that as long as I continue to say the prayers that were necessary and understand, again, I'm not in charge, things can go pretty well. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, that was the purpose all along. We try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. Kenny looked at me one night after, it was Friday night, Elizabethtown, Kentucky was my home group. And he looked at me one night after meeting, and I need a refill, but he said, who do you think you could ask in your life about how good a program of Alcoholics Anonymous you run? Your sponsor ever ask you a question, you don't want to answer it? That was my response. And I said, I don't know, Kenny, who could I ask? And he said, how about your wife? How about the person you live with? it's not all that difficult for me to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and act principled. I can do that today. I can act principled. I can shake hands. I can smile. I can small talk. I can do those things today. But can I go home and act principled when things aren't going my way? Can I be compassionate to the people I love the most? Can I do those things? Because it's not just important for me to carry the message here. It's important for me to carry the message out there. Otherwise, when someone new comes into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, what are they going to see? Me sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous looking all spiritual and principled, and a week ago I was flipping them off on the highway. What would his response be? Thank you, Dan.
Very much.
Good bartender. All right, so what's it like today? What's it like? It gets exciting because I started out by saying it's beyond my wildest drunken dreams, and it's just simply true. It's just simply true. I can't sometimes believe what I experience on a daily basis. Helen and I have two kids. I shared about my son. He's 20. He's 20 years old. My daughter is soon to be 19. We planned it that way. I'm kidding. Didn't plan it that way. They're 13 months apart. They're absolutely amazing kids. To my knowledge, my son has never taken a drink of alcohol or used a drug. He simply told me I didn't want to take the risk, Dad. Excuse me? He said, I just don't simply want to take the risk. That's all. Oh, okay. All right. Actually, and I need to share this, the book tells me I need to be neutral about alcohol. Then I can be just neutral about it. It's not good or bad. It's just alcohol. 2 weeks ago, I was in Chicago on training and having supper with the judge I was talking about earlier. And we just ordered some pizzas. And the judge looked at me and said, do you care? And she was very nice about it. She said, do you care if I order a glass of wine? I was like, well, no, judge, I don't care if you drink some wine. Just don't spill it. And she's like, what do you mean? I said, I don't know why. It still just pisses me off when people spill beer. If you can't drink responsibly, you know. And she kind of laughed. I said, it's kind of like alcohol abuse, you know. It just is. I don't know why, but it does still irritate me. Anyway, let's see. My daughter's still living at home. She graduated high school in June. My son is in the Army, soon to be coming home from Iraq. We hope in November is what our hope is. What is it like? We have a foreign exchange student. I don't know if my wife and I are glutton for punishment. Well, I don't know. But we just decided to take a foreign exchange student. Her name is Soraya Wang Satyatnon. Took me a while to pronounce that. Wang Satyatnon. Whatever. All right, I'll keep practicing. It's an amazing young child. Amazing kid. It's kind of funny, though. I came home Monday night. My daughter had asked me if I wanted to go out to Red Lobster, and she'd buy. I was like, okay. All-you-can-eat shrimp? Yeah, all right. So we went out to Red Lobster. I came home, and as I came into the house, Helen and Jane, she goes by Jane, are sitting at the kitchen table, and Jane has a parka on, her winter jacket, with the hood up, sitting at our table eating supper. She's from Thailand. She's never seen snow. It was hilarious. I had to take a picture, you know. I'm going to get a movie camera out or something when it actually snows. It's fun. It's exciting to learn about a different country and a different culture. We've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it tremendously. Not that long ago, my son decided, this was when he was in high school, he decided that he was going to go out for track. Now, in high school, I went out for track. And after 3 weeks, I got kicked off the track team. I remember this distinctly because for some reason in high school I could jump and I could grab a 10-foot rim. And so I decided I should go out for track and do the high jump, right? And I was doing actually all right after 3 weeks. I could jump my own height on a pole. And I just remember the coach, Stitch, and he came up to me and he said, you can't drink when you're on track. I was like, you mean I can't drink like every day? And he's like, yeah. Well, that ends that, you know. It's just beyond my comprehension back then. So I didn't make it in track, but I played basketball. I loved basketball, and I always hoped my kids would play, you know, go watch them and have fun. And you know, Well, my son decided to go off for track his junior year in high school, and he did it because when he was like a freshman, he ran a mile in like 6 minutes flat in gym class. So the track coach was interested in him always coming out. And I remember his first track meet at Chi High. And seriously, guys, I thought this would be like watching, going to a track meet would be like watching grass grow. You know what I mean? Paint a wall and watch it dry. That's how exciting I thought it would be. And so we get to this track meet at Chi High, and Helen hands me the camera because she can't, some reason, focus and push the button at the same time. Sorry, but she can't. And goes, tells me to go to the finish line. He's doing a 100-yard dash. He's never done this before competitively, right? So I didn't know what would happen. I just stood at the finish line, and they shoot a gun off, and they take off, right? And I'm trying to get the camera right, and he came in first, his first competition. I mean, he didn't win it, but in his heat, he was first out of six guys. He ran 100 meters in like, it was like 13 or something. It was a good score. And he came up to me, and he was like, I did it for you, Dad. I did it for you. Do you believe these things? Do you believe them? I struggle sometimes to believe them. That all these things are possible. That today, I can have a relationship with my children, with my wife, have a sponsor, close friends, and that I can talk to them, and there's no fear. There's no fear. My son sent me a letter a month ago, and he said, I'm his best friend. I'm his best friend. Do you believe these things? I'd love to tell you that I am a great father, great husband on my own. I would love to tell you that, but I wouldn't be honest. What I simply try to do is take the principles you've taught me and teach them and live them. Just live them. Do I struggle at times? Yeah. I do. I am human. I am human. So I'm going to try to wrap this up because it's almost 8 o'clock with one of my favorite parts of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And since my memory is not seeming to work tonight, I'll do my best. If you're as seriously alcoholic as we are, we believe there was no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life had become impossible. And we passed in the region from which there was no return through human aid. We had but two alternatives. Two alternatives. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other is to accept spiritual help. And this we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. Our founders wrote this. They said they had found much of heaven and been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence beyond anything they had ever dreamed. That's what they wrote. If you are new here tonight, that is the spiritual significance of keep coming back. You got to be here. You have to physically be here to get on the rocket. It's the only way we'll get you there. We'll get you there, but you got to be here. God bless. Thank you.